Welcome to Bending the Arc. Bending the Arc is a show by the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition and offered here on KKRN Community Supported Radio. In this show, we are in conversation with people in the North State and throughout California who are working for equal justice in the criminal legal system. In today's show, we'll be in conversation with U.S. Attorney Philip Talbert about the work of his office, the Hate Crimes Task Force, and trends that he is seeing across the North State. The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the people being interviewed, not that of KKRN, SEJC, ACORN, or the underwriters of KKRN.
We'll turn around and just start over. We'll turn around and just start over. We'll turn around and just start over. For the time is drawing near.
We have on the show today U.S. Attorney Philip Talbert. And I'd love to begin with you introducing yourself to our listeners however you wish to do that.
Great. Thanks, Sharon. And it really is a pleasure and an honor to be here on your radio show. I'm Phil Talbert. I'm the presidentially appointed United States Attorney for the Eastern District of California, which covers 34 California counties from the California-Oregon border down to and including Bakersfield. So pretty much all of the Central Valley and the Sierra Mountains.
Great. And a little about your history. How was it that you came to be U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District?
Well, I hope that's a great story, Sharon. I grew up in Southern California, the Los Angeles area. I spent very little time here in Northern California. I'd never been to Sacramento until I interviewed for a job as a federal prosecutor here. Let me back up a little bit. I went to law school at UCLA. I assumed I was, based on my background, I was going to become a business lawyer. But my first year, first semester of law school, I took criminal law and I was hooked. And I thought, this is the most interesting thing ever. I want to, you know, be an attorney in, criminal law, probably a prosecutor, hopefully a federal prosecutor. I interned at the LA County DA's office. I went on after law school to clerk for a federal court of appeals judge on the Ninth Circuit, where I handled some of my cases that I handled with him were federal criminal cases. And while I was a clerk for the judge, a brochure came around chambers advertising the U.S. Attorney General's Honors Program. And so I got interested in that. I applied. It was the one way you could get directly from either law school or a clerkship into the U.S. Department of Justice. And I was able to get a position in the criminal division back in Washington, D.C. That's where I started in 1990. And other than a short foray into private practice, I've been with the U.S. Department of Justice ever since. I knew I wanted to be what's called an assistant United States attorney, which is a career prosecutor in one of the U.S. attorney's offices out in the field. That's where the vast majority of federal criminal cases are prosecuted. I applied all over the place. I'd never been to Sacramento until I interviewed for the job here. And I got the job here in 2002. And boy, was I lucky. I fell into a great office, a great district. And I've been here ever since. I kind of moved up the ranks here to being a supervisor. And then I was the first assistant, which is the top career lawyer assisting the U.S. attorney in running the office. I was the first assistant for both the U.S. attorney during the Obama administration and the U.S. attorney during the Trump administration. So as you see, while the appointed U.S. attorney may be a political appointment, our office is completely apolitical, nonpartisan. And after I'd been the FAUSA, the first assistant twice, I put in during this administration to become the U.S. attorney. And it is my honor to serve in that position now during this administration.
You know, when I've seen you present here in Reading, and I believe I was somewhere else, you're very energetic and positive. And I wonder what it is that you enjoy or that motivates you about the work that you're doing currently?
You know, the work and the casework drew me, and the role of being a federal prosecutor and helping decide what cases get prosecuted and which ones don't, and then implementing that and you know, being in court, trying to persuade judges and juries of the rightness of our cases, that was all a challenge. The longer I was in the office, like I said, I became a supervisor. I was the training chief for a while for the new assistant U.S. attorneys who would come in. And through that and also being the appellate chief, I became more responsible for the work of the office more generally, not just my own work, but the work of others. And we have a great office and we do great work. We have great people. I often say that we're the best law firm in the Central Valley. That is really true. We have great attorneys. Everyone else wants them. They're constantly trying to hire away our people, and they succeed in some. But it, you know, this last step of becoming the U.S. attorney means that I get to lead this office, of which, you know, I learned a lot, and then I've helped develop, and I'm very proud of. And I get to do it in a place that over the past now over 20 years, I've gotten to know as home. And we live in a great district. We've got all sorts of, you know, interesting cities, urban areas, but lots of rural area. You know, the mountains, the agricultural part of the Central Valley, really interesting and great people, and from very diverse backgrounds. I'd hazard to say that our federal district is the most diverse district in the country. One, because we just span such a large geographic area, 34 counties, we're half of California. But two, we have, you know, we have people whose families have been here for generations and generations. We have people who showed up yesterday, people who, you know, don't speak English as their first language. Lots of those, or a wide variety of religions and traditions that are practiced in our area. And all of them are to be treated equally under the law. And, you know, a large part of our job is to make sure that happens and make sure that they're protected, that they're safe, and that their civil rights are protected.
Yeah, and you mentioned a little bit about your work, but I whenever I have someone on the show, I want to make sure that people understand the particularities. So on your website, you have all these programs that are under your office. I almost want to say jurisdiction, but how do you describe to someone who isn't sure about all the differences what your office is responsible for? How cases come to you?
Right. So on the most basic level, we are the attorney for the federal government here in our federal district in these 34 counties. So what that means as a practical matter, we have three statutory responsibilities. One is to enforce federal criminal law. So we prosecute federal criminal cases in federal court. The DAs are prosecuting state law violations in superior court. We're prosecuting federal criminal law violations in federal court. That's the biggest responsibility we have. We're also responsible on the civil side to represent federal government agencies when they are sued. Just like any private employer, they may be sued for employment discrimination or a medical malpractice for the, you know, the hospitals, VA hospitals and others, community medical centers, and other types of suits like that. We also bring affirmative suits on behalf of the government to recover where U.S. government interests have been damaged. The big ones there include things like healthcare fraud, where monies, you know, Medicare and Medicaid monies are diverted by fraud to providers who are, you know, defrauding the government, and also in our district, wildfire recovery. So where individuals or companies' negligence has resulted in a wildfire that destroys national forests, national park, then we might bring suit. We at least investigate, might bring suit against them for recovery. And then our third main responsibility is to collect monies, whether it's restitution that's owed to crime victims or asset forfeiture involving crimes the proceeds of crimes or property used in crimes to recover those monies. But again, going to those are the three things: the criminal enforcement, civil litigation on behalf of the government, and then also recovery of monies. Of those, most of our resources are on the criminal side. So about three quarters of our attorneys are federal prosecutors.
One of the ways, given our mission, that we initially contacted you was through Alan Ernesto Phillips, who serves on your hate crimes task force, and he's one of our steering committee members. And as you know, and as our listeners know, we have had some higher profile incidents in for us in recent years. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the purview of the hate crimes task force, that struggle that we who are not in your office often have about what constitutes a hate crime, and without speaking about the particulars, what kind of incidents or trends are you grappling with currently?
Great. Those are all great questions. Let me try to sort them out, address them one by one. First, let me say Alan Phillips has been a great partner in our office, his community outreach up in the northern counties. I really appreciate the help he's provided to us over the years and his participation in the hate crimes task force. Let me start first with just kind of what is a hate crime. Hate crimes are actually probably more accurately termed bias crimes. So if there's some bias that is leading the offender to commit the crime, then what we need to show is not just that the crime was committed, but also that it was motivated by a bias. And the reason why hate crimes are so important to us and to others in the enforcement business is that these crimes are not really just against an individual victim, if it's an assault of some kind or if it's vandalism or property damage. It's really a message crime against a community, and usually these are underserved communities of others, and the message is that you don't belong. You're not deserving of protection. You're not. You don't belong in our society, and that's just false under our laws, under our Constitution, under Bill of Rights. Everyone here belongs and deserves a protection. Everyone's civil rights under the law need to be protected. We share this responsibility with the DA to enforce hate crimes laws. The district attorneys have a fairly strong California state law governing hate crimes. So it may be us, it may be the DA who eventually prosecutes a hate crime in one particular county or another. That's usually based on kind of a complicated analysis of the laws that govern and which federal law governs and what the prospective penalty is and how easy it is to prove under various laws. But as far as trends, things that we're seeing, while I'll say as a general matter, there's a variety of different groups that tend to be targeted by hate crimes. Most often, there's one group that are committing hate crimes, and those are white supremacists or people who follow some kind of, white supremacist ideology. The statistics, whether you're looking at national statistics that the FBI collects or state of California statistics that the California Attorney General collects, both groups of statistics, year in, year out, tend to show that the Black community is targeted most. As a matter of just numbers of statistics and cases that we have prosecuted in the past have included both vandalism, property damage types of crimes, and also assaults on individuals. Next up, generally the statistics show that the Jewish community and the Muslim community, hate crimes mainly, but hate crimes generally based on religious affiliation tend to be a large number too. What we see both in our district, and we also see here and across the country hate crimes against the Sikh community, who are not Muslim, but offenders tend to, who don't know any better, tend to assume they're Muslim too, and so they get targeted too. We've, of course, what stands out in our district, 1999, the Summer of Hate, and the Williams brothers, the synagogue and house of worship arsons that they committed here in the Sacramento area. But since then, we still see more recent vandalisms of houses of worship, including some recent vandalisms of local mosques. So we're seeing that. And then really since the pandemic, of course, and I think it's been in the news a fair amount, we saw an uptick of hate crimes against Asian American and Pacific Islander community members. On the again, kind of assumption of offenders that somehow they all caused the pandemic, whether they were Chinese or not, anyone who looked potentially Chinese. And so we're focused in on all of these things and all of these areas, and looking to make cases where it gets reported to us, and we're able to do that, or to support the district attorney if they're better positioned to make a case, and then doing a lot of community outreach to encourage people to report when they've been victimized by hate crimes.
Yeah, and I do have a question about what we can do and some effective community response for agencies like ours. But first, is there also a trend in bias crimes against the LGBTQI community, or is that more in certain areas of our region than others?
We've seen those, and the statistics bear out that that is a it's a significant number within those large groups that I've mentioned, that and mainly there, from what we've seen, are assaults against LGBTQ plus members. And of course, obviously nationally, the things that we've seen, we just saw the Department of Justice charge and reach a plea agreement with the offender in Colorado who had attacked the club there, and then we're all familiar with what happened in Orlando at the Pulse nightclub, and so this is this is something that we're very concerned about. We're very concerned about people acting out on this hate against the LGBTQ plus community, and particularly targeting places that are specifically designed to make them feel more comfortable and more open with each other.
And you mentioned white supremacist groups. The one group that gets discussed a lot in our area, the Proud Boys, are they the most active in our region that you know? What are some other ones that are important to know about?
Looking at the cases that we've handled in our district, and what we've investigated, and knowing the way that the FBI conducts investigations and what it does not investigate, of course, we're always concerned about groups that are espousing some kind of bias or hatred, but the FBI only investigates where people are going beyond First Amendment protected activities and actually engaging in things. So the cases that we've had individual members of groups who commit hate crimes and hate incidents, but they tend not to do it as a group matter. So for example, there was a case down in Bakersfield a few years ago where an individual who was a member of a Peckerwood gang, which is a white supremacist gang, tried to scare off a Latino family from a neighborhood, yelled a racial epithet to them, and then shot a shotgun at the man, the father and husband, while his family was looking on in his own front yard. But the evidence was that that was, kind of, that was his decision to do. It wasn't kind of an organized gang plan to do that sort of thing. So we see these hate crimes happen, and we can often find the ideology of the person, or they're motivated in some way, but it's not necessarily like we would see in, you know, drug trafficking or sometimes violent crime, or sometimes fraud, where there's a group that are conspiring and they're making plans together to commit these crimes. So that's one of the frustrating things about it, frankly, is from a law enforcement perspective, it's hard to figure this out ahead of time, as opposed to just being reactive. It's easier in some of those other areas of our law enforcement responsibility to be run proactive investigations and to you know, charge and arrest an entire group of people for crimes they are engaging in. But often these hate crimes, it's something that's reactive, where we only find out about the person's beliefs and ideology after the fact.
I was going to ask you what you have seen are effective community responses for organizations like ours, and you know many of those organizations here in Shasta County. And I'm also wondering what are some best or promising practices for law enforcement to engage with those groups that we know promote those ideologies, even if they're not committing an act as a collective.
Right. So the first answer, I think, from the community's perspective and what they can do in effectively responding to acts of hate, is stand strong together. You know, there needs to be a public statement that this is wrong and it's not acceptable, and there's strength in numbers. So the more community leaders that stand together and give that message, the better. So we've had the good fortune to work with an organization called Not in Our Town to show a couple films involving hate crimes up and down our district. The first one that we showed at three different Cal State campuses is called Waking in Oak Creek. Oak Creek, Wisconsin was the site of a mass murder by a white supremacist of Sikh victims at a gurdwara. Again, probably assuming they were Muslim, even though completely different religion background. And the film, Waking in Oak Creek, while it discusses the shooting, the event itself, most of the film deals with the community response to that shooting, and how the community, different parts of the community came together. There was a lot of discussion of how people who were not Sikh didn't necessarily know the, you know, what went on in that, you know, gurdwara down the street, and you know who these people are. But after the events, they all got to know each other very well, and the gurdwara opened its doors, and people came in, and then the rest of the community was very welcoming to the Sikhs, to the Sikh community, and also you know, making clear that they opposed what had happened too. And so they built a lot of community bonds through that. Then, and so we screened that film. We had a discussion panel afterward at each one to talk about how can the community come together without something like this happening to be stronger in the case we are tested in this way. And then more recently, Not in Our Town produced a film called Repairing the World, which focuses on another horrific hate crime, the one in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at the synagogue, the Tree of Life. And again, while it discusses the events of the mass killing, the focus is on how the community in Pittsburgh came together to stand strong. Different parts of the community, the Jewish community relied on the African American community, came out very much in support. The Muslim community came out very much in support. And you have all these different community leaders and community members interspersing with each other to show, you know, it's called Pittsburgh Strong. And so we showed that film here in Sacramento at the Crest Theater. We showed it down in Modesto recently. I know when we showed it in Modesto, along with the Modesto chapter of the NAACP, one of the comments from the audience was how much they saw of their community in Modesto in Pittsburgh, that there was already a fair amount of community strength through different groups coordinating, getting to know each other. Head of the NAACP knew the head of the LGBTQ plus center. They knew the mayor. They knew and people know their police chief and others. And so it's heartening to see that kind of community strength when we show these films, and to hear about that and to see the diverse group of people that come out to watch the film and engage in the discussion. So while I hope nothing that significant and horrific happens in our district, I do feel like, we would come together in the same way, the various communities that we have here in the Eastern District of California.
Mm-hmm. And are there things that law enforcement can do for existing if existing white supremacist groups are identified, if there hasn't been any indication of overt action, is there anything that can be done or monitoring that is common?
Well, I mean, I guess first and probably most obviously, and something that we really can't talk much about is right. that when things come up, when information comes to us that people are planning on engaging in some kind of criminal activity or might be doing that, then we're running, secret covert investigations of that activity to try to keep keep something bad from happening. So a lot of our a fair amount of our work in the office is working with the FBI on these types of investigations, again, that we can't talk about,
right.
where we think there might be something that might happen. And they can be very frustrating because something hasn't happened yet. And so you're looking to gather evidence. You need the predication. You don't investigate someone because they've engaged in First Amendment protected activity. You investigate someone because you have, potentially probable cause or some reasonable suspicion that they're committing a crime or going to commit a crime, and then use the tools that are available to you to investigate that over time. But really, a big piece that law enforcement can do and that we try to do as effectively as we can is to reach out to the community. And to build community trust in law enforcement. So, we found that the strongest that we can be as a district against threats like this is when law enforcement has the trust of the community that it serves. We work with federal law enforcement like the FBI, the DEA, and others. We work with state and local law enforcement, like California Highway Patrol. We work with, of course, the police departments and sheriffs up and down the district. A lot of times in our community outreach, we will try to join with representatives from those offices when we go out to a community event and just engage. And the first thing is just introducing yourself and saying who you are and that you're there because you care, because we see our jobs in the U.S. Attorney's offices and in law enforcement as serving the community. We live in the community ourselves. We serve the community. We've partnered with many of our, police chiefs and sheriffs and FBI and other, federal law enforcement agency, special agents in charge in doing this kind of community outreach to build the trust. So that's why often when you see us, you'll see us in tandem with others, because we're trying to build that trust. So if something does happen, then it's more likely to be reported. It's more likely that we'll have the cooperation of the community. It's more likely the community be willing to stand up with us. So there's a single consistent message that, particularly with hate crimes, they're wrong. They won't be tolerated. We'll investigate and prosecute where we can, and that you need to report. So, and I should put in a plug for reporting. So, if anyone thinks that they or someone they know have been victimized by a hate crime, and they don't have to necessarily know that it's a hate crime, just some kind of incident event they feel like was came out of hate or bias against a particular group, then they should report it. First, if there's an emergency, then of course call 911. But once the situation is no longer an emergency, then we recommend calling both your local police, or if you live out in the county area, then your local sheriff, and also the FBI, because we both potentially will investigate, or both offices will potentially investigate. To call the FBI, easy number to remember, 1-800-CALL-FBI. They've got it's a national number. They've got language assistance in a number of different languages, so it's likely you'll be able to talk to someone. If you don't speak English, that likely you'll be able to talk to someone who speaks the language that you are comfortable with, and report it. And even if it isn't a crime per se, if it's not something that can be charged, it still makes both the local police and the FBI aware of what's going on in the community. Sometimes there's someone who does a number of things that aren't a crime, and if no one stops them or calls them on it, or at least asks them about it, then they'll be persuaded that nothing's going to happen and they'll go ahead and commit a crime. Or it may be that there's an area of our a district where there's a lot of things happening, and it'd be nice if law enforcement knew about it so they could intercede before something, something became a crime. So I really encourage reporting. I know there are some people, some parts of the community that may not have the trust in government or trust in law enforcement to make that call. If you trust the local police, call them. If you trust the FBI, call them. Call both if you trust both. If you don't trust, then please, you can reach out to our office. Our interest is in protecting the people in our district. It's not to it's not to find people who may have immigration troubles, or whatever the sorts of things that we are looking to protect everybody in the district.
Yeah, it sounds like you're really talking about a triangle of trust that you and law enforcement people and you people and your community members and law enforcement, so that that information can get passed on to whomever is best positioned to address the issue. A related issue that we have been experiencing, and it has come up in a number of my conversations recently, is online and in person, in public meeting, personal through email, bullying and threatening of people who speak out. It appears to be fairly gendered. We see it a lot more with women who are either in positions of power or journalists. And for us, we have many concerns, but we're concerned about how it might dampen civic engagement and that building of trust that you were speaking of. What are some approaches that communities are taking to both document and counteract?
A fair amount of that speech is going to be protected by the First Amendment, and I think having a First Amendment that protects our free speech in this country, there are costs to that. We have to put up with a fair amount of speech that we don't like, we find repugnant, but I think first of all, off from the community's perspective and from individuals' perspective, the First Amendment encourages a marketplace of ideas, right? And there are a lot of bad ideas out there. And to counter bad ideas takes good ideas and speech about good ideas. So I think the more that people who believe in the ideals that are embodied in the Constitution, believe in the community that we have, believe that the diverse community we have here in the district is a positive, which I believe, then speak up about that, because I think the good ideas in the end will outweigh the bad. At least that's one of the theories of why we want free speech in the first place, is that good ideas will eventually push out the bad. So for community leaders, elected officials, my own personal belief, it's I'm here as a U.S. attorney enforcing law, but my own personal belief is that their role really is in part to speak out about the good, and to speak out in favor of the benefits diversity and you know, acceptance and tolerance and that within our community. And then again, when there's something that comes out like a hate crime or something that's very concerning, then there is strength in numbers. And the more that we see different community groups coming together and community leaders, you know, shoulder to shoulder, speaking out with one voice, there's a lot of power to that. And I think that can, you know, that can garner a lot of support within the community. But you know, the First Amendment does mean that we'll have to listen to a fair amount of you know, kind of repugnant speech that we don't like.
How would people find out what constitutes crossing the line in terms of those threats? If it's a direct physical threat, does that cross a line? Or, and I, by the way, I completely agree with you about changing norms and culture and what's acceptable by speaking out more about the good and what's accepted or not accepted, like not in our town does.
Well, and so threats are a difficult thing, or a complex issue under the law for us. As a general matter, for a threat to be outside of the First Amendment and to be against the law so that we would prosecute it, a threat generally would have to be directed at some person or organization, and with some kind of notion that the person, you know, has an intent to carry it out, or is at least, you know, communicating an intent to carry out the threat. So there can be a lot of bad language out there that sounds bad, but it's not really a prosecutable threat. But there are threats that we do prosecute, whether it's, you know, something that's online, transmitted electronically, or by phone, or letter. And we do prosecute threat cases. They tend to be some difficult cases because they really turn on, you know, was the person really intending to carry it out? Would an objective person receiving the threat believe that it might be, you know, carried out and might be concerned about their safety? So there's that area where, you know, crossing the line that falls under our purview and that we would investigate and potentially prosecute. We also do a fair amount of work in the civil rights area. And one area I'd like to highlight is on our civil litigation side. We're often in the position of doing investigations and cases that would support protecting people's civil rights when it comes to voting, when it comes to housing, when it comes to access to hotels, restaurants, stores, those sorts of things. And they're, you know, whether it's you know, the bias based on race, or it's we have these cases involving sexual harassment by landlords against mainly female tenants, and or if it's, you know, kind of more typical civil rights types of access to restaurants and that. And hotels, or basic access under the American with Disabilities Act statute. So we do a fair amount of civil matters there. I would like to do more. This is an area that during my time as U.S. attorney, I've been advocating in D.C. for more resources for our district in this area, and I do intend during my service here to increase the amount of civil rights work that we do. A lot of that's going to depend on outreach by our office to make sure that we're reaching out to underrepresented, you know, parts of the district who are probably having their civil rights violated, and you know, either they don't know it, or if they know it, they don't know what to do about it. So again, large part of our job is reaching out and letting people know who we are, what we do, and you know, how we can you know, how we can help them if, you know, if they're in need.
That would be wonderful. We have a very dedicated legal services of Northern California for our area, but they only have so many staff and there's so many needs. So that would be great to have more resources. Anything else that you wanted to bring to this discussion that hasn't come up or that I haven't asked you?
One thing I want to tout that my office has been one of the co-creators of, one thing we're concerned about is that while we do have this very diverse community, the people who are in the bar, the lawyers who are representing all of the interests up and down the district, we tend to not be as diverse a group. And so as part of our duty to help better our profession, we are working to lower some of the barriers to people from diverse backgrounds and groups to be able to get into and thrive in the legal profession. One way that we're doing that is a couple of years ago, we partnered, my office, the U.S. Attorney's Office, partnered with the two big law schools in our area here in Sacramento, UC Davis and McGeorge. And we started what we call the Sacramento Diversity Career Fair. And what it is a way for diverse law students and diverse younger lawyers to connect with employers who are interested in recruiting and hiring them as lawyers at their law firms, government agencies, what have you. We participate in it. Many local law firms do, government agencies, courts, court agencies in the kind of greater Sacramento area. And greater Sacramento area, I'm including a lot of the northern part of our district. Mm-hmm. We started this a couple of years ago, first time at McGeorge Law School. We had a good attendance. We did it again recently, just a few months ago, for our second year. We doubled the number of employers who participated. They're so interested in this. They really want the applicants and to connect up with them. And we had more people participating. And we are bound and determined that this is going to be an annual event from here on out in the, you know, kind of greater Sacramento area. So something that's, you know, may seem a little bit out of our lane, but again, as I said, being the best law firm in the Central Valley comes with some responsibilities toward the legal profession itself, which is we're going to help diversify the lawyers, not just in our office, and we try to hire a diverse group of lawyers in our office, but across the legal profession in our area. We have an interest in seeing that happen, and you know, we're working on it. We just held it recently. I think it's now set for the fall, so it'll be next fall, and it'll either be at McGeorge or UC Davis likely, and I'm sure there'll be even more employers. You're looking to, you know, hire even more and more students and younger lawyers from diverse backgrounds. So it's Great. Something that I'm proud of. As I said, I'm proud of a lot of our casework. I'm proud of our office. But this is one thing that I'm particularly proud of that we help start.
Thank you so much, U.S. Attorney Philip Talbert, for being with us. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sharon, for sharing the time and allowing me to speak.
Tell me. And now I have the pleasure of speaking to Alan Ernesto Phillips. Alan's been on the show before, and he is actually on the steering committee for the Shasta Equal Justice Coalition. And U.S. Attorney Philip Talbert was speaking about his role, so I welcome him here into the studio to tell us a little bit more from his perspective working with Philip Talbert. So welcome, Alan.
Thank you so much for having me again, Sharon. I appreciate it.
Sure. So how did you first get involved with the Hate Crimes Task Force?
Back in the late 90s, California was facing a lot of clear and convincing hate crimes. For example, synagogues being burnt, the Mattson Mauder murders that happened here in Happy Valley. When they were murdered, the U.S. Attorney's Office got involved. And at that time, our former District Attorney, McGregor Scott, was at the helm. The Hate Crimes Task Force sort of evolved under his leadership and subsequent U.S. attorneys, and has been kept alive to date. So I got involved peripherally with the Hate Crimes Task Force. At the time, I was helping to co-found the Northern Hispanic Latino Coalition, and I didn't want to give the impression of having conflicts of interest at the time, so I didn't join the Hate Crimes Task Force. So I worked with U.S. Attorney Scott at the time, conversationally and giving him alerts, and he had told me about the Hate Crimes Task Force, but I stayed on the periphery, but in full support. So that's how I really got involved, when I actually saw a federal and state agency get behind investigating, prosecuting, convicting, and sentencing people who have been charged with substantiated hate crimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. I didn't know that history. There
has been a faction, I think, of individuals who rationalize and even theologize hate. Typically, what we see are some of the kind of the extreme right-wing, so-called fundamentalist Christian organizations who are essentially white supremacists, Christian supremacists. It has an audience. Hate has an audience in Shasta County, historically speaking, but also in current times, we see a lot of people who will buy into that hate culture, not meaning that they themselves are actually going to perpetrate a hate crime. They've gotten a little smarter, and so they try to perpetrate hate under the radar of a crime and actually get active in what are considered hate incidents. Hate crimes are traditional crimes: arson, murder, vandalism. These types of cross-burning is considered a hate crime. But hate incidents that have been around for a very long time but are getting much more attention lately, maybe the last 2 to 5 years, has been perpetrated by organizations from Sacramento, Davis, and recently Chico. It has come up into otherwise peaceful Northern California by some of these groups. And what they're doing is they're going around to different households and putting out Ziploc baggies with hate media, anti-Jewish, anti-people of color, that kind of hate information to peaceful residents who didn't want any of this sort of stuff on their front lawns or on their porches, on their private property. These pieces of media are really designed to give misinformation about our wonderful Jewish communities across this nation that kind of include all of our media is owned by Jewish people and they're out to take over America. And so you get this kind of misinformation and I think disinformation. But also we're seeing anti-LGBTQ literature being disseminated.
Growing up here, Latino, Indigenous, as you are, you had many experiences that led to not the most trusting relationship with law enforcement or the legal system. And you shared last time some of those experiences. What was it about, or is it, about the Hate Crimes Task Force and what is happening at the U.S. Attorney that has led you to remain involved?
That's a really good question. Being a brown child in Shasta County, early on was very, very difficult, getting picked last for sports and being called names, getting into far too many fights with white kids. But for me, that pain and that trauma growing up with it has always been inside of me. And I've tended to be kind of an advocate for people who are bullied. I've changed a lot of my thinking. As I got older and more educated, I just had that burning sense inside of me, sort of a PTSD that was unresolved and untreated. And I decided to treat myself and to get more educated. I actually went through some therapy to deal with some of my PTSD mm-hmm. issues mm-hmm. Related to racial culture trauma. Mm-hmm. And but I never did much with it for years. I got involved in the film industry. I got involved as a journalist. And I wasn't able to do much with it until I started seeing other people stand up and speak out. Mm. When I saw others being braver than I was at the time, standing up and saying, hell no, we're not going to take this crap. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, that made me feel like, oh, I found my people. Mm. It wasn't color. It wasn't sexual identity or national origin or anything. Mm-hmm. It was these people were standing up for the right thing. Mm-hmm. That's what got me fired up and got me involved. I've been doing this for decades now, and I'm going to continue.
That's just recognizing the multiple forms of good that has, right? The people that yeah. you're inspiring or giving strength, or who might feel like they're not alone mm-hmm. in wanting to stand up.
Yeah, I was told some time ago that... It's a fascinating way to look at our culture, and it's put this way. There are people who are part of the problem. There are people who want to be part of the solution to the problem. And there are a vast majority of people who just want to be part of the landscape and wait for somebody else to do something. I choose no longer to be a part of the landscape. I choose to stand with people who want to do the right, fair thing in life.
If people see something that they're not sure if it constitutes a hate crime, hate incident, what do you encourage people to do with that information?
First thing, stay safe. I really recommend that people don't get involved in direct conflict with somebody who may be perpetrating a hate crime or even a hate incident. And at the same time, be present in thinking about collecting evidence. It takes thinking. I mean, your heart is pumping. You can hear your heart beating in your neck. You're sweating. You're shaking. You're nervous. You're seeing somebody being confronted by a potential hate crime or hate incident. Observe. Get out your phone. Record it. Look at the physical characteristics of who you perceive to be the perpetrator of the incident. What color is their skin? What long hair, what color? Clothes they're wearing, pants, shoes, car they're driving, get a license, collect evidence. That's one of the most important things for being able to have law enforcement get active to support us in stopping hate. Mm-hmm. It's difficult, especially when you're in the situation.
Yeah, so it sounds like definitely contact law enforcement and give them as much information.
Exactly. Yeah, collect the information. Contact local law enforcement first. If you meet with somebody who seems disinterested or is not taking a report, you can request that a report of your call be memorialized. They have to write down who's calling, what the incident is about, who may have been involved. You know, listen to the words of our brilliant U.S. attorney, Philip Talbert. He really is a grounded, neutral, most caring steward of our community. But keep listening to this station. You're going to collect a lot of information by being here. Stay vigilant. I love you all.
Thank you so much, Alan.
Who are you? What have you become? What have you done to this beautiful kingdom? I don't want your guns, I don't want your poisons, I don't want your weapons and tools of mass distractions. I don't want your red flags, don't want your baggage, I don't want your hate speech, your supremacy. Where are your wives? Where is your rough edge? Don't tell me you've traded it for comfort and privilege. I don't want your fast foods, I don't need to buy shit. I don't want your miles and miles of advertisement. I don't want it, no, no, no. So step up, speak out, show up, be loud. 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 Be loud. Peace of mind or a piece of the pie. 9-to-5 living in a plastic empire. Where is the house for the wounded and homeless? Can't sleep on the streets, can't afford to own this. Everything is I, me, me, my, mine. Busy working for the dollar while the well runs dry. Minimum wages, maximum security. Simple pleasure traded for business.